Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to Season 2, Episode number 18 of Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio is...
Just Kaylee! Well, not just me, us. The two of us.
Exactly, and it should be quite a tight show this one without that Simon slowing us down.
Slacker.
So, just the two of us, and we'll rattle through all of the topics for discussion. In today's scintillating episode, US politics goes under the comic microscope and the campaign. Modern love goes under the dramatic microscope and Take This Waltz. The dark side of the moon is under the telescope in Iron Sky, and how far can I push this? British Country House comes under the micro... No, that doesn't really work. Anyway, in Cheerful Weather for the Wedding, we'll also talk to Academy Cinemas owner John Davies about the recent demise of the Victoria in Devonport, which he was managing, and tell us a bit about what's going on at the Academy as well. Very interesting interview that I did with him earlier on this morning. But before we get into the show, let's have a look at what's in the mailbag.
Yes, indeed. I was just looking out the window at the skylight, because there's sun out there, it's still light while we're recording.
I know.
Goodness. It's amazing. So diving into the tweets this week, Miriam Ruth Ross, who of course we had on the show last week, her review for No, a film festival title, simply buenísimo. Mr. Stephen Moore, who I got to meet at Holy Motors. And speaking of Holy Motors, we will be talking about Holy Motors a little bit later on the show. So if you did get to see Holy Motors and you're confused as we are, or if you didn't get to see it, you get to have a little bit of a...
Yeah, we had a request.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, and so like all good rock bands, you know.
We're going to play the hits. Shut up and play the hits. Mr. Stephen Moore, two-word review for Marina Abramovic, egotistical introversion and dreams of a life in inexplicable isolation.
Oh, and that's actually one that I really regret not seeing now, actually, Dreams of a Life. That was that was one I actually had a ticket for, and then due to my the requirement that I see Take This Waltz, I had to, I couldn't be in two places at once, unfortunately, and now I'm cursing.
Oh, any word on it coming out later?
Dreams of a Life, I would doubt it.
Oh. Maybe we can find out. We can harass Madman. They're pretty receptive to us. Rudy Six for a regular cinema release, Le Chef Delicieux Ratatouille. Well done, guys. Thank you very much. And from the Merca, Clown Danish Curb two-word review.
And talking of meeting listeners and meeting fans, we had coffee with Rudy Six on Sunday, didn't we?
We did.
He was down in Wellington and made it very clear that he would like to meet us. So it was very nice to meet you, Rudy. And next time you're in Wellington, let us know, and we'll do the same thing again. And which goes for all of our listeners, in fact.
Because I got to meet a few of our listeners who
during the festival.
Yeah, so I got to put a face to the tweet, which is great. So thank you to everyone who recognized my face or my voice during the film festival. It's nice to meet you as well.
Indeed. And keep in touch. So what have New Zealanders been watching if it hasn't been the festival?
Number five. Not a lot has happened during the festival. Most of the, because there haven't been a lot of releases, so things have kind
no,
of been
it has been very quiet on the
sitting.
New release front. Yeah,
things have been sitting. So, still sitting at number five, we have Ted. Number four, Magic Mike. Opening at number three this week is The Campaign. Sitting still at number two is Step Up 4 Miami Heat, or Step Up 4 Revolution, depending where you are. Mm-hmm. And still at number one after 4 weeks is The Dark Knight Rises. So people are still going. I actually had someone I've spoken to on the phone, people asking if we're playing Dark Knight in 3D at the cinema. So just so you know, it's only in 2D.
That's it. So don't be too disappointed when you don't get a pair of glasses with
it's loud enough to maybe be in 3D, but...
I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. But anyway, I did spend a couple of sessions going to commercial pictures this weekend and was very pleased to see how busy they all were. Reading's in Wellington was very busy on Sunday afternoon. So, you know, not everybody was at the festival. And it certainly, you know, the Sunday was very much a movie-going weather day, wasn't it? So, people are still going out, and
yes.
They're still going to see whatever is being released. And now, with the festival finished in Auckland and Wellington, I think the breaks are coming off a wee bit, and there's a whole lot more stuff coming out.
Yes, actually, there's a flood of festival titles that are being released right away, which is kind of nice. So if you missed out on any and you want to catch up, there are plenty on their way in. The end of this month, September, October, it all kind of floods through the gates. So it's a great season to be going to the movies. So put that spare change aside.
Yeah, and one in particular, I Wish, the Japanese movie, which I think is possibly the fastest release that I've ever seen come out of a New Zealand International Film Festival. That's already playing in Auckland. We didn't get a chance to see it in time for this particular show, but opens in Wellington this weekend, so we'll be featuring it next week. But what are we going to be talking about on this particular show? Well, it's time to go from the sublime to the ridiculous, really. Festivals, from festivals to feral. I've just got to push my fader up.
How you doing?
Hate to break it to your friend, but your balloon's getting ready to pop, and that balloon's full of your own butt toots.
Are you trying to trash talk me?
Your mama's like a vacuum cleaner. She sucks, she blows, and gets laid in a closet. That's what nuts feel like.
Stop it. Washington, D.C. is a mess. How do you say it's a mess in Hebrew?
Balagan.
Donkey Kong?
You want a holy war, little man?
Let me hear a Cam Brady 012. Oh, shove a throwing star up a Chinese monkey.
All right.
I'm sorry, I started laughing at the word butt toots.
So it looks like I'm going to have to start talking about this one. The original plan for today's show was that Grant Robertson, the MP for Wellington Central, was going to be given the job of reviewing this see whether in New Zealand hair is as important as it is in the American electoral campaign. Unfortunately, Grant was too busy this weekend to do that. And, you know, in my opinion, perhaps he actually dodged a wee bullet there because, you know, this is just another Will Ferrell film. I know that you enjoyed it.
I did. I didn't think I would enjoy it. Like, I was because the older Will Ferrell gets, kind of like his shine kind of wears off for me. Like, he was fantastic during
A little goes a long way.
Yeah, he kind of, you know, I remember growing up watching, you know, in my teen years, watching him on Saturday Night Live, and he was just great. But yeah, he's wearing off a little, but I laughed out loud several times when there's a lot of times I was laughing and I actually had a few claps for some of the jokes.
Really?
Oh yeah. There's times I laughed that other people didn't get it, but I think it helps that, you know, because I think Will Ferrell's character so what happens in the film is it's two candidates are running for,
it's a congressional seat, I think.
Yeah.
So in the US politics, correct me if I'm wrong, listeners, in US politics you have the Senate, where there's 100 of them, two from each state, and then you've got the Congress and the Congress people, and that's sort of based on like electorates in New Zealand or the UK context, and so there's lots and lots of those. It's a big house, so there's like a lower house and an upper house, and so I would say that it's probably based on my understanding of this film that the talent pool is not that deep once you get to sort of congressional level. And the idea is that Ferrell's character is a Democrat who is in such a staunchly Democratic, they never really talk about this, but it's such a staunchly Democratic part of West Virginia, I think, that nobody ever bothers to run against him, that there's just no way that he could be beaten. Not, they don't really explain why, or you'd think he's such a doofus that somebody would have thrown their hat into the ring. Anyway, the multi-billionaire Motch Brothers. Is that right? They're the Motch Brothers, based loosely on the Koch Brothers, who are the shadowy figures behind most of American politics at the moment. So Dan Aykroyd and John Lithgow play these two characters who, in order to further their own business interests and basically bring cheap manufacturing back from China to America, which, you know, you'd think would be a good thing, apart from the fact that they want to pay people less than the Chinese get paid, they decide that they need control of this particular congressional seat, and they stick a candidate of their own choice up against Ferrell, and it's and he's played by Zach Galifianakis
in a wonderfully camp role.
He's always that's not a big stretch either. That character, is it? That's not he's not as if he's rewriting his own.
No, I feel that character is like a small sidestep from his character in The Hangover. And for Will Ferrell, it's a very, very small sidestep from his Bush impression.
Yes,
so it's characters we have seen before. But, you know, because they know the character as well, it's kind of...
And they obviously play well together.
They
do. That's something that about it, that there is some quite good good sort of relationship stuff. The film is... Did we have a rating? We haven't talked about ratings for a long while, but it's an R-rated thing, isn't it? Because it's a bit. The language is robust, shall we say? It's definitely a grown-up picture, and it just felt to me tonally a wee bit sort of off. You know, like kind of randomness about the jokes and blue humor, which, you know, I don't normally have a problem with, but. There just seemed something like it was trying a bit too hard to be sort of edgy and grown up and offensive, when I would have rather had a bit more character development and a bit more plot.
I think one of the reasons I enjoyed it, because it wasn't vulgar. It was a Will Ferrell film that wasn't really kind of vulgar and disgusting. There was comedy and there's some kind of adult moments, but it wasn't...
Toots.
Bum butt toots. I was sitting there and I was laughing at some of these jokes that a lot of the it was, you know, Tuesday, there's probably a lot of students there who didn't get the jokes. I did feel that if I was in Canada watching this, I would feel maybe a bit more into it. They are going through kind of like election heats at the moment. It's kind of right on time, whereas and a lot of the humor was kind of American pop culture references and small town America references, so I can understand why, you know. I've been in New Zealand for 2 years now, so it's kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, American funny. But I still enjoyed it. I think my favorite moment is when, of course, and most of us would know the famous incident where they're parodying, but they to boost his numbers, Will Ferrell's character decides to go hunting. Zach Galifianakis' character shows up in the parking lot, gets out of the truck, shoots him in the leg, and walks away.
Interestingly, if you check out the trailer online, obviously that they've gone and shot whole sections of the film twice, because I'm guessing for to make the trailer G rated. So when you watch the trailer for that particular scene, he doesn't shoot him with a gun; he shoots him with a crossbow,
Would have had. Like some pretty good comedic value as well.
Yeah,
crossbows are funny.
Yeah, well, there's a big question: are crossbows inherently funnier than guns? Who knows?
I don't know. We did see a crossbow in a 5-year engagement, so maybe it would have been a double up.
Oh, maybe. Mm, yeah, but it just one of the things that I think that tends to happen with Ferrell films is that they shoot a lot.
Mm.
You know, they do two or three versions of the version that's written down, the scripted version, and then they just keep going, and you know that randomness I find quite tiresome. You know that I think we could probably all. It's like how many monkeys in rooms with typewriters do you have to have before one of them writes Hamlet? You know, it's
how
like
how many rants do you let Will Ferrell go on before you cut it,
and before you get a funny one? You know, it's eventually I'm sure this happens. So. I don't know. A lot of this will depend on to what extent you're a Ferrell fan and a Galifianakis fan. If you are, then you will be satisfied, because they don't surprise you and they don't sort of they don't diverge too much from the formula. Do you have two words?
I think my two words will be comedic caucus.
Comedic caucus. Oh, okay. Mine's democracy. No. And
or what about a democratic no?
Maybe
because democratic no sounds much stronger. Like that is a definite no.
Yeah, okay, that's true. It's arguably the least politically sophisticated film about politics that I've ever seen.
Definitely.
So don't expect to get any kind of understanding of actually what the issues are between the parties or anything like that.
It's maybe to aid sophistication, do a double feature with like Frost Nixon or something.
Yeah, possibly, but even or get that the Clooney film out and you know, watch something a little bit more dramatic as a balance. But either way, you know, I don't imagine people will be too unhappy at that state of affairs.
Hi.
Hi.
I think I'm sitting here.
I'm sorry. No, I don't know you from somewhere else.
Not that I know of. You look really familiar, though.
Yeah. Hi. We're making two stops. 62 McLaughlin Crescent.
Really?
And, yeah, why? Where do you live?
Pretty close, actually.
Oh.
I'll walk from your place. Slow it
down. We've almost reached. I'm married.
Oh, that's too bad.
And we cross live to our Canadian hipster correspondent.
I was waiting to see what kind of correspondent it might be today. Yes, definitely. Actually, I'm looking at the Flicks review. Indie romantic drama. Mm-hmm. While Dan cringes at those three words. Yes, Take This Waltz is a Canadian film and directed by Sarah Pauley, which is one of Canada's sweethearts. She directed Away From Her and starred in Road to Avonlea for several years. I'm not sure if you guys got Road to Avonlea here. I was talking about someone once.
No, we must have done because my sister really loved it when she was little.
Okay. Yeah. So, yes. Directed by Sarah Pauley, and it is about 28-year-old Margot, played by Michelle Williams. She's happily married to Lou, played by Seth Rogen, who is a cookbook author, but when she meets handsome Daniel, played by Luke Kirby, a dashing artist who...
Handsome Daniel, I like those. Handsome I like Daniel. That phrase.
Yes, the handsome Daniel. He's an artist who moved in next door. Their mutual attraction strains Margot's belief in her marriage. So it's a film about... kind of that midlife, but
it's about sort of like the 7-year itch, isn't it?
Yeah, 7-year itch, 30-something crisis of, you know, I've settled, but I'm in my 30s, but I still feel like I'm in my 20s.
Is this what I want to spend the rest of my life doing?
Is this the real life? Yeah. Is this just fantasy? Mm. So yeah, I find that Michelle Williams is. It's kind of unfortunate, but she's fantastic in these kind of moody, unhappy female roles. Like she really does really well. Like we saw her in Blue Valentine and the road trip one. She has her dog.
Oh God, I love that one.
Wendy and Lucy.
Wendy and Lucy, yeah. Yes. That's just so gorgeous.
So this is yet another film for Michelle Williams to really just like do so well in. Seth Rogen, I was hoping to see a bit more from him. He's, you know, known for comedy and like being a bit of a stoner weirdo.
You know what I think? I think that it's actually a self-conscious attempt on the part of Sarah Pauley to subvert or to reverse the normal rom-com expectations, right? Mm. So normally in a rom-com, the female character won't be particularly well developed, and she'll be some kind of caterer or she'll be a chef or something like that, and like the kind of parts that Katherine Heigl always plays, and what was in Bridesmaids, what was she? She baked cakes. She was a chef.
A failed pastry chef.
Mm. That's right. And so so I think it's actually quite a nice touch to make him a cookbook writer.
Mm.
Because, you know, that does. It completely reverses the usual expectation. And, of course, he's just as one-dimensional, really. He's obviously there to be the lovely guy, you know. He's not... But there's no real development for him and no real sort of arc for his story, unfortunately.
Mm.
And not much room for Seth Rogen to be Seth Rogen, which may be a good thing. You know, it's not his film, so.
Mm. But he is looking good.
He is. He's kept that weight off, hasn't he?
Mm.
Yep. Mm. Despite all the chicken that he's that he cooks in the film.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed this film. I mean, it's about... It's about struggling with commitment and you know, deciding what you want and whether, you know, stick with stick with something safe that, you know, you're married and you have duties and you should, you know, be loyal to that. Or, did you know, you've meet someone and you fall in love and maybe you should just go with them instead. And so, yeah, it was, I think I found it was, maybe I can relate. I'm, you know, I'm heading towards 30. I can see myself having one of these crises at some point.
I think, and I think everybody, I think everybody has them, and they, you don't just have one either, you know, in life. There's always moments where you just go, I'm on the road now. Where, how do I get off? You know, how do I, you know, you can't get there from here, you know. But also, I think that there's, I guess it's depending on your stage of life, how you feel about the decision that she ultimately makes will be completely different. You know, I think I've talked to a few people who feel very strongly, and I don't want to get too much into this because of this spoiler potential. But who you know, feel that, you know, she should stick it out with her man, and that the whole point of relationships is that they are hard work, and that you get the rewards if your head doesn't just get turned by the first sort of good-looking, fit rickshaw driver who moves in across the road. But having said that, you know, do you really stick with something that isn't working? And there are enough scenes in the film where you feel like, you know, it probably isn't working. And she's probably the only one in the film that is prepared to address it. You know, like, he knows but doesn't want to talk about it. And so neither of them really want to face up to it. And she just decides to sort of detonate. I had some real problems with the film has these moments of great insight, great emotional insight, and moments of great truth where you just go, wow, that just plays really truthfully. But they're scattered amongst the whole lot of really awkward, contrived, eggy stuff. And a lot of the direction, the script makes a really big effort to tell you exactly what you should be thinking about these characters. And, you know, when the rickshaw driver and Michelle Williams meet for the first time, it's on an aeroplane, and they have the most contrived conversation on that plane. First of all, they met by accident previously before at a fort, at a tourist fort, I think I got off on the wrong foot with the film at this point, because the first thing that she does when we see her is that she's researching, writing the new brochure for this tourist attraction, and one of the things that happens at this reenactment fort is an adulterer is in the stocks and has to be whipped by somebody. And so the first thing, it's like, oh, okay. Right, I get it. Oh, what's going to happen now? She's going to whip this adulterer, and then she's going to feel, you know, there's already manufactured connections being made. Mm-hmm. Talking of connections, then there's obviously that the very first thing she says to this guy when they're on the plane is, I'm scared of connections. Well, oh, really? Do people talk like that to the people that they've just met on an aeroplane? I don't think so. So, no, it's, you know, and little things like she's just had a row with Seth Rogen, and she goes and lies on the bed, and clouds cross over the skylight, and her face goes dark. And it's like, yeah, I think we get that she's not very happy. I don't really need to be shown. So I found that frustrating.
Mm.
And I think that after Sarah Polley made Away From Her, which was so subtle and let the performances do so much of the work, and it almost didn't feel written at all, you know, it felt like it had just sort of emerged fully formed. And I love it when I don't feel the hand of the screenwriter, whereas I felt very much like everybody was being moved around like chess pieces on this particular film. So a disappointment for me in that respect. Yeah.
Was she the screenwriter? Did she co-write it?
No, she wrote it herself.
Right.
And maybe that's part of the problem. It didn't feel as confident as Away From Her. And I don't know, and yet I would imagine because of her age that this is something that's closer to her own life experience. So
yeah, that's what it felt like to me, is because we're getting that female point of view that you know, possibly the reason that it feels a bit contrived sometimes and overdone is because it's so close to her personally that it would be a very difficult film to make. And, you know, sometimes you just make the wrong decisions when you're under pressure looking at your own life.
Yeah, yeah, and wanting to do it justice, I guess, and wanting to explain it to everybody and make sure that they get it.
Yes, but also, you know, it did, for a Canadian film, it did go through the very, like, archetypal, like, Harold Greenberg fund, Telefilm funded, like, all the steps for most major films.
Right.
So I also am wondering how much of a hand Telefilm had a hand in saying what the final product was, because
right.
that happens as well.
Because
so Telefilm...
That's interesting because... yeah, that's interesting because... Because quite often you can watch a film, and if you are aware of the development process, or if you're aware of the influence that executives have and funders have, and it's something that I've noticed on occasion with New Zealand films, is that you sort of wish, oh, you know, I wish they hadn't given it one more draft, you know, because it's just they've sucked all the goodness out of it, or they've sucked all the originality out of it. That sometimes happens. So maybe there were just a whole lot of executives and funders going, you know, we really need to make it a bit more obvious for the American audiences. I don't know. But
no one will want to watch it unless we tell them exactly what's going on.
Yeah, I think Sarah Polley is just a fantastically gifted filmmaker, and I think that this is maybe just a misstep from my point of view. You enjoyed it a lot more than I did. And I know that Rochelle Becker, who has been on the show in the past, absolutely adored it. And so, but she wouldn't come on the show today to tell us that. She's shy now. But there is a range of opinion about it, and it does split people. Two words.
Because this is Sarah Polley's second feature film, I believe, and if I'm wrong, then please correct me, and I'm the worst Canadian film fan ever. I'm going to go with Sweet Sophomore.
Mm-hmm. Well, mine is Wrong Decision.
Who are these guys anyway?
Nazis from the moon.
One word from me, and the invasion from the moon begins.
Invasion? Y'all must be tripping.
Now my question is, what do y'all plan to do about it? Because we just happen to have a little something up our own sleeve. All presidents who start a war in their first term get reelected.
Okay, this is just a new feature on the show, the mini review, partly because I'm the only one that's seen it, and partly because this is a film that's going to come and go from New Zealand cinemas in fairly rapid fashion, I think. It's one of those films that event cinemas seem to be showing just by themselves through their network just for a very short period of time before it maybe a DVD or a home video release. The Warrior Ultimate Fighting film was a bit like that. So this film, not in very many places, called Iron Sky. I remember when the trailer came out a few months ago that people got very, very excited. And there were a lot of people at the Embassy Theatre in Wellington on Monday who are very, very excited about this particular film.
Is it a Kickstarter film?
No, I don't think so. It's. I'll tell you what it is. It's an extremely weird combination of funders. It's a Finnish, German, Australian co-production.
Oh, excellent! That's why we have it here.
Yeah, and so some of it is actually shot in Australia. Some of the effects are done in Australia. It's conceived and designed and directed by a Finn, but a lot of the cast are German. To give you, I don't think it's the simplest idea in the world, really. Imagine that at the end of World War II, the Germans perfected their rockets, and instead of using those rockets to blow up their enemies, they shot a whole lot of Nazis onto the dark side of the moon, where they discovered helium-3, a bizarre fuel source which allowed them to build a swastika-shaped castle, I suppose, on the dark side of the moon. And because it's on the dark side of the moon, nobody knows it's there, right? This is 2018. The Americans finally decide to visit the moon again for public relations reasons. The president is Sarah Palin, or somebody who could be Sarah Palin, decides that this is a very important public relations trip. They immediately land on the go and have a look over the hill to the dark side and discover thousands of Nazis.
So it's kind of like Prometheus, but with Nazis.
Yeah, Prometheus with Nazis. And but what's interesting is that because it's 60 odd years, no, more than that, 80 odd years since the end of World War II, these Nazis, they don't think of themselves, like all the kids and the young people think that the Nazis are good. They're bringers of peace. And they are, they're all about good, wholesome things, which is, it's probably not a million miles away from what the actual Nazis thought of themselves anyway. But there's a new Führer played by Udo Kier, a great German actor. And they capture the one of the American astronauts who has, of course, a smartphone, which is more powerful a computer than any than their entire computer, and they decide that it's time for them to go back to Earth, get some more smartphones, and then power the massive computer that's going to drive the spaceship that's going to allow them to go back to Earth and conquer the world. If this makes any sense to you at all, then you are a better person than I, because it was narratively a complete shambles, to be perfectly honest. It really is just an excuse for Nazis, steampunk, American political jokes, jokes at Sarah Palin's expense, cynical sort of satire. And it's actually, you know, none of it quite works. It's like, there's a huge amount of effort gone into this, a lot of sort of green screen, digital, fantastical steampunk imagery going on, but it felt really dated to me. Like, it felt like I was watching something that was actually conceived in 2008, which it probably was, and not very funny either. That's just a wee bit of a problem. So, but the guy behind me hooted like you wouldn't believe. I almost moved because he was so annoying. If he's listening, it wouldn't be the first time that I've embarrassed myself talking about somebody who actually listens to the show. But no, he just genuinely, he had the most annoying laugh and just hooted all the way through it. So, you know, maybe I'm just a little bit out of step. Maybe it was post-festival blues and I was just... you know, didn't bring to it the right sort of amount of energy, but it really didn't work for me at all. So one really good idea. It felt like a 48 hours film with a really, really big budget. So you're gonna want two words for me now, aren't you?
Yeah.
Spectacularly unfunny.
Oh, you've been disappointed all week.
Yeah, maybe I need to find something that I love soon. Mm. Or this is going to be a really depressing show. All right, news time.
Last Wednesday, British cinema legend Bob Hoskins announced his retirement from the screen following being diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Hoskins is 69 years old, and his most recent appearance on New Zealand screens was as a dwarf in Snow White and the Huntsman.
What a fantastic character actor, Bob Hoskins. Elevated pretty much everything he came into contact with. And, of course, that news made me want to go and find...
Michael J. Fox.
Well, in case he's got the cure. No, I was thinking Who Framed Roger Rabbit and, you know, some of those great Hoskins performances, and just remember, you know, because, you know, and I was also interested that, you know, the choice of the word retirement, and just as a complete sidetrack there, you know, somebody was mentioning about how David Bowie has retired, you know, and he was invited to play the closing ceremony of the Olympics and said, no, I've retired. Thank you. And I was thinking...
What a gentleman.
Well, I was thinking...
Sir,
I can't quite imagine Bowie retiring, you know? Like, this is Bowie. You'd think he'd want to keep on making fantastic music and play. You'd think that would be the kind of thing you'd want to do until you drop, like the Rolling Stones have done, are doing, for example. But no, this idea that, no, I've done that now. I just want to play with my kids. Thanks. And totally respectable, but just a kind of impenetrable decision. When somebody's ill in the way that Hoskins is, you can say, why would you want to put yourself through that? And when time is limited, you absolutely want to spend it with your family. But yeah, it's, in show business terms, the idea of retirement, it seems kind of a weird thing, to be honest.
Does anyone really ever retire?
No, we're going to be doing Cinematica till we drop.
Ah! The New York Film Festival announced its opening title earlier this week. Ang Lee's Life of Pi will get its world premiere in the Big Apple on the 21st of November, and it's the first 3D movie to open the New York Film Festival.
Very exciting.
Ooh.
Have you seen the trailer for it yet?
Yes, I have.
Is it good? I haven't seen it
yet. It looks fantastic. It's very, like, visually, like, stunning. There's a lot of very interesting things going on. I'm not a humongous Ang Lee fan, so...
But the great thing about him is that, like, he tends not to repeat himself. So even if you're not really a fan, you can trust that you won't be getting the same thing over and over again.
Thankfully, because The Hulk. Ooh.
Yeah, which I haven't seen, actually. And I sort of feel a bit of an obligation to go back to it and give it a go at some point. But I love the book of Life of Pi. And so that's I think, the big thing for me.
I think visually.
How are you going to do it? How are you going to do it?
a lot of digital, but it looks stunning. It's going to be stunning, especially in 3D. It's going to be a very immersive experience. If you can get to see it in IMAX 3D, I think it'll be amazing. So, Tom Cruise is slated to star in a remake of The Magnificent Seven, which has just secured a writer. It will be Nick...
I love giving you these.
Nick Pizzolatto's first big screen credit after making his name on television, including The Killing and True Detectives.
And I had a quick squiz at Mr. Cruise's IMDb profile, and this will be his first Western after all these years. Yep. So on that basis alone, I kind of think that would be kind of cool, actually. And, you know...
Probably because it would most Westerns would involve, like, mounting a horse, and you have to be... And they'd have to find kind of like a miniature horse.
A box.
You have to get on an Apple box.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm glad Tom Cruise is still working. Good for him.
Yeah. That was only a little bit patronizing to the biggest box office star in the world.
Yeah, watch out, Scientologists will start following me. And finally, Warner Brothers have announced that the first installment of The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, will only screen in 48 frames per second at, quote, select locations. There's no word yet on whether those, quote, select locations will involve anywhere in New Zealand, but with several cinemas retrofitting or installing the new equipment, you would certainly hope so.
Yeah, this was going to be a question for Cy, actually. It's a shame he's not here. Maybe we'll talk about this next week. But I know that a lot of the work that he's doing with the new locations that he's constructing, you know, the intention is for them to be technically ready to be able to play The Hobbit in the way that Peter Jackson intends. And I hope that people aren't losing their nerve, I guess, or that Warner Brothers aren't losing their nerve.
Well, I have heard a rumor that there is a conference in Australia coming up this weekend, and that there will be a few companies who are going to show that they can do 48 frames per second. So trying to sell into the Australia New Zealand market just in time for The Hobbit, because this is all for The Hobbit. It's like the big digital changeover for 3D for Harry Potter. That was a big push a couple of years back. So this 48 frames is the new big money push.
It is. The money push. That's actually a really good way to put it.
Investment push.
Yeah. Last week on the show, we mentioned that the Victoria Picture Palace in Devonport was going to cease showing movies, at least temporarily, and there's going to be a change of management there. Earlier on today, I got to talk to John Davies, who had the management contract for that particular cinema. It's always a bit sad when we hear about cinemas closing, because you know you feel like, you know, it's a tough business to be in, and we love supporting people who are still doing it, and people are still opening cinemas. But I guess that means that occasionally some will have to close. John Davies is also the owner of the Academy Cinema Complex in Auckland. I spoke to him this morning.
John Davies, welcome to Cinematica.
Thank you, Dan.
That's excellent, loud and clear. We've wanted to get you on the show for quite a while. We know you're an excellent talker and a passionate advocate for cinema exhibition in this country. Unfortunately, the reason for getting you on the show this time round is, a little unfortunate in that you have been running the Victoria Picture Palace in Devonport, and last week you announced that you're no longer running the Victoria Picture Palace in Devonport. Can you give us a little bit of background as to what the Victoria was all about?
Yeah, well, obviously, the Victoria, first off, it's probably worth noting, is the oldest purpose-built cinema in New Zealand, possibly in Australasia, possibly it's even claimed in the Southern Hemisphere. So it's a very old cinema, 100 years old, in fact, this October. We reopened it 2 years ago, there was a lot of flurry and happiness and joy and curiosity factor for the first few months. And we were going up and up and up in the right kind of general direction. But unfortunately, we stopped about 20% short of where we needed to be and stayed 20% short of where we needed to be pretty much throughout the 2 years that we were open under my management. It's probably worth noting the cinema is supposed to reopen under new management and with a new business model next month, and it won't fundamentally, I don't think, be quite the cinema that it was in terms of being a cinema, but it will be potentially open. In my case, we We almost closed a year ago when the Rugby World Cup came along. It completely devastated us. We lost, I think, around 70% of the revenue we had been getting and dropped to levels that were just completely untenable for that 2 months of the Rugby World Cup. Within a week of the Rugby World Cup finishing, I think probably like most cinemas around the country, we saw revenues start to restore themselves. The industry certainly didn't help itself during the Rugby World Cup. The majority of really strong films were held back during that period so that they wouldn't have to compete with the World Cup. There were a few brave distributors. I remember Sony Pictures released The Smurfs in that period, and that was great for the school holiday period, but I'm sure the film underperformed to its true potential. But across the board, there was just a lot fewer films in that period. We kept playing old films. People weren't coming out anyway, regardless of whether you're playing an old film or a new film, and just life was terrible.
How many screens, sorry, John, how many screens are there at the Victoria?
The Victoria has two 35mm film screens and one electronic cinema screen, so a grand total of three. Which is probably pretty much the minimum number you can get away with these days in terms of running an effective cinema operation.
Yeah.
The product line that we offered for Devonport was a product line that basically came about through my sitting in Devonport for the 3 or 4 months before we opened and looking at the potential audience. And it unfortunately was a very disparate audience. You had to try and cater for families, you had to try and cater for the nearly deads, and you had to try and cope for, entice out the people who were interested in art house films, the middle-aged and 30-something group. So it was a really disparate product line that was needed to make the place work.
But that's true of a lot of, I guess, neighbourhood cinemas. We've got a few here in Wellington that have to sort of tread that line between soft art house, family movies, school holiday packages, all of those sorts of things.
It's a difficult thing to do.
But Devonport's a reasonably prosperous part of the country, I would have thought. They had been aware that the Victoria had been sitting there unused on their doorstep for quite a long time. I mean, the community itself had been sort of, prior to it reopening, had been crying out for it to be restored and reopened for them.
Yeah, the heritage value of the building was never in question. People really, really wanted to keep that building. Whether the vast majority of the neighbourhood really wanted a cinema is another question. And I guess we'll find that out a little bit more as the new model comes into play. But the fact of the matter is that it is a small community. There are 16,000 people living on the peninsula itself. And the entrapment that occurs through the single road access to the area and the desire of most people from outside of the area to travel in by car, not by ferry, was definitely an issue to try and deal with. People would arrive in the area and find that every parking space had a parking 60 sign on it, or almost every parking space, which is not a challenge that other neighbourhood cinemas in Auckland face. If you travel around the other neighbourhood cinemas in Auckland, none of them have that parking restriction around them. So it was definitely a interesting challenge to cope with. And under Auckland Council as opposed to North Shore City Council, we certainly got a lot more visits from parking wardens. But anyway, the real issue with the product was that, and you're seeing this now in Howick, for instance, with the new Monterey Cinema, which opened as an art house. I think it's 4 screens. And it's a fully digital cinema. It opened as an art house. It is now playing, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Killer?
Right.
And other great films like that. And the simple fact is that it is becoming very, very difficult to cater to a specific market in a specific area. And that certainly played out in Devonport, and more difficultly in Devonport, of course, we had to deal with the fact that our closest art house opposition was owned by the two distributors that controlled 75% of the volume of arthouse product coming into New Zealand and did not supply a single arthouse film to the Victoria after it had been open for 3 months. The interesting thing was with the Victoria, we did exceptionally well in the opening quarter with a couple of films from one of the distributors that do own the Bridgeway, and it looks to me like we were too successful because within 3 months of being that successful, we were not getting any products from them. Presumably, someone sat down and went, "That's all business that would have come to the Bridgeway if we hadn't if we hadn't supplied them." And I think that success actually hurt us more. One of the two distributors was not supplying anything and never did throughout the whole period that we operated, and so that was the bigger of the two in terms of volume. But the one that did supply to begin with stopped supplying after 3 months, and you have to say after great results, like we did 4% of the national box office on one of the films from that supplier, and then never got another film. Normally success breeds success. In this case, success breeds failure. And frankly, we've seen communications between people that we probably shouldn't have seen. They were sent to us accidentally, where people were talking about how we weren't allowed to have those films because those films were controlled by a distributor who the Bridgeway. So it's been an interesting battle. And look, if we had got films from those people and there's one major studio that wouldn't supply us for that whole period as well, if we had had films from those people, that might have made the difference. But, you know, we were pulling a massive amount of the average ticket spend by population in our area. The average ticket spend in New Zealand last year on movies was $36 per person in the country. And we pulled about 85% of that $36 out of our 16,000 people. So we did pretty well. It's just that, unfortunately, when I built the targets for the business, I didn't look at multiple ways of how those targets could play out. I looked at one way and went, yep, that works, and got on with it. Right. Had I done multiple projections for the business, I might not have actually gone there at all.
Now, your focus is now back on the Academy, where you've been. You've been running the Academy for a long time now. How long is it? 8 years? 9 years?
I think I'm in my 7th year.
And how are things at the Academy?
Dreadful. Thank you for asking.
Any more dreadful than usual? You usually got something to complain about.
Much more dreadful than usual. Unfortunately, last year the council moved into our street and ripped it up, and kept it ripped up for 7 months. And then we had 2 more months of the Rugby World Cup, because in Auckland you had to cease all roadworks the week before the Rugby World Cup. So the roadworks finished. They were not completed. They had done half the roadworks. They've come back this year to do the other half. Our business dropped by 75% last year.
That's extraordinary.
It's extraordinary. You know, you could say to me, John, art houses in the central city have been going downhill for years, and I would say, yes, you're absolutely right, Dan, and we were, but we never dropped 75%, and I doubt you can find anywhere that dropped 75% a single year. That came down to the roadworks. It wasn't the roadworks themselves. It was the fact we had to be closed because the roadworks were causing noise to travel through the earth strata and into the cinema.
Because you're in the basement, aren't you, of the public library?
We're not in the basement. We are 3 stories underground. it's not just a bunker, mate. You know, it's a nuclear disposal site, if you want it to be. We're 3 stories underground, and every jackhammer noise within 100 metres seems to hit the earth, go down into the strata, and bang against the side of the cinema. We could not be open from 7 a.m. in the morning, when, of course, we weren't open anyway, through to about 7 p.m. every night. Wow. And so we lost our early evening sessions, we lost all our daytime sessions, we lost all our film festivals because we couldn't run properly. We negotiated a silence for 3 weeks for the New Zealand Film Festival last year. Didn't work. Council didn't pay any attention to the agreement they'd made. So the only festival we ran in the whole of last year was the main New Zealand Film Festival. Every other festival abandoned us. and you can't blame them. And as a result of going to other places, they didn't come back. Mm. So our revenue model at the Academy was always built around festivals and art house films in between the festivals. That model is dead for us. So at the moment, we're busy recreating.
That was going to be my next question, actually, John, is that you are a strategist, and I guess you're working hard on what the strategy for the Academy should be. What conclusions have you reached?
It is very much a work in progress. To be fair, I might be considered a strategist by some people, but I'm sitting here going, I don't really know. What we're trying to do at the moment, we're trying to get people used to coming back to the place. That's the first step. And we're trying to play films that fit the Academy tradition. And are trying to work our way back into public awareness. I mean, God bless our souls, we're the most liked Facebook cinema location in Auckland. No one apart from the whole event chain is better liked than us. And I think that's because we do interact with our customers. We're very upfront with them. Our people are pretty knowledgeable about films. I'm there a lot. I host the big event sessions that we run, the Rocky Horrors and the Rooms and that kind of thing. And so people do get interactive with us. They do feel they can come and tell me something and that there's a chance they might actually influence our programming. They do. I mean, we're playing a film right now that's fresh out of the film festival, Shut Up and Play the Hits, the LCD Sound System documentary. And that came to us not because John knew anything about LCD sound systems 3 months ago. It came to me because someone on Facebook said, maybe John Davies at the Academy Cinema will play this film. I did the research, chased the film down, and we were able to open it straight after the festival. And it's that kind of thing where we actually listen to the cinema goers and try to give them programming that they want. That will hopefully contribute to rebuilding the awareness of the cinema. Mind you, it was always Auckland's best-kept secret as far as cinemas went anyway. I mean, it's been there nearly 40 years, and still I would say 80% of Aucklanders have never heard of it. It's always pleasing to be in the foyer of the cinema and hear, wow, I've never been here before, it's so cool. I don't hear very often, this is interesting, I hate this place, why are we here? Thank God. I do hear it once or twice, you know. That's why I mention it, because I do know it happens. You know, three flights of stairs can put people off. And possibly my jokes about we're all going to die if there's an earthquake don't go down that well. But, you know, I'm there dying with them, so, you know, they should feel good. Captain going down with his ship or something. Oh, God, that's black, isn't it, Dan? Sorry.
No, we're all looking forward to a brighter Academy future, one way or another, John.
Yeah, well, I think it exists. We've got a plan for going digital. We've got the finance for going digital. So the ability to continue on into the future with the new DCP environment will be there. And at the end of that, we will be the most flexible cinema in Auckland. We will have 16mm film. We will have 35mm film. We will have digital. We will have electronic. We will play your Blu-rays or your DVDs or even your VHS tape, Dan. We can play them all.
And that's a fantastic feature to be able to offer people from a cinematic point of view.
VHS tape.
Well, no, just the flexibility, John. You know, the fact is that you know that flexibility does make a big difference, even if it's you know it's not necessarily commercial cinema, but from a higher-edge point of view and from an accessibility point of view, all those things are important.
The biggest part of our business right now, to be honest, is private events. That's the focus of regrowing the place too and increasing awareness of it is getting more volume audiences down into the place who've never been there before. They pick up a brochure. Hopefully they remember it. Hopefully they look out for our ads and our online stuff. And that's where we'll carve out a niche.
John, thanks very much for your time. Been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thanks, Dan.
You know Dolly, she likes to take her time.
She didn't take her time about marrying Owen Bigham.
The fact is, Dolly has got the ring.
Priceless.
If you're doing this to be difficult, get out while you still can. Dolly's always been attracted to danger.
Last summer, we were practically inseparable. What if he begged me to run off with him?
Dolly.
While everyone was sitting in the church waiting for me.
Dolly!
For goodness sake, what would I do?
You do want to marry Owen, don't you?
Opening across New Zealand tomorrow, if no, actually today, if you're listening on a Thursday, that is Cheerful Weather for the Wedding. And we've both seen that, which just means that we can both talk about it.
Yes, and a nice follow-up to Take This Waltz. A very British take on what's a woman to do.
They could be yeah, two completely different cultural versions of exactly the same story.
Mm.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I love about watching so many films in any given week, is that you do get these amazing congruences like that. So yes, Dolly, played by
Felicity Jones,
who is the it girl, isn't she, of British cinema at the moment. She is sitting in her bedroom getting drunk in her wedding dress,
I'd say she has sequestered herself.
Yes, that's right. So she obviously not mad keen on the idea of the wedding that's about to take place. And this is a country house in, what, the 1930s?
1932,
there we go. It was not a bad pick on my part. As all of the guests gather in the drawing room and the dining room, and the servants mutter about this, that, and the other, she sort of has to be coaxed down the stairs to the wedding. And then there's various flashbacks as to this is a Christmas wedding, and there's flashbacks to the summer and the romance with somebody who is not the groom. And she's obviously in a bit of a quandary about whether to go through with this whole arrangement. So, yes, very similar to Take This Waltz, not after 5 or 6 years of marriage, but on the cusp of it.
Mm.
And does she make the same decision? Does she make the right or wrong decision? You know, so we're not going to tell you, because you know we don't do the spoiler thing here.
No, but her the reason it's so difficult is because her past lover is a guest at the wedding, who she has invited herself. Complicated lady decisions.
Yes. for the first sort of 2/3 of this film, you think that this is just, you know, another English costume country house drama, and it even has Elizabeth McGovern in it from Downton Abbey.
For me, it was like the Downton Abbey Christmas special.
Well, see, not watching television, I only know Downton Abbey by reputation. But I was sitting there thinking, oh, haven't we seen this all before? And then it amps up the drama a wee bit, doesn't it?
Mm.
And it does, I think, a fantastic job of getting quite spicy. To the extent that by the end of it, you've been through quite a solid dramatic situation with difficult questions and some fine acting, and you know, this is actually a really good film.
Hmm. And yeah, it's an interesting pace as well, because it unravels quite slowly, because it's not over a long period of time. It's over, you know, an afternoon basically. But it's, yeah, the performances are fantastic. I love the 1930s portrayed in cinema. Like, the costumes are always beautiful. The settings are always really, really great.
It was a golden age, wasn't it, in so many ways?
Yes.
That Mr. Hitler ruined everything.
But yeah, you know, it's with the flashbacks, it's balanced quite nicely. So though it's a winter wedding, so it's quite blue and bleak, and the summer is like warm and orange, so you feel the romance and like the heat of the sun, and it's quite beautiful and really draws you in. And even though it's not a really fast-paced story, I got really involved with all these characters.
I think it's actually it's the slow pace of that first two acts that actually sets up the drama for the third act, when all the clues that you've been given over the first two, because it doesn't come right out and say what the issue is. You have to pay some attention, and then when finally all the strands are drawn together, it's really quite powerful and quite meaningful and unusual as well. So it's a terrific little film.
Mm.
Cheerful Weather for the Wedding, and as I say, opens nationwide from Thursday today.
Mm.
Do you have two words for it, Kayleigh?
I think my two words are just going to be rather British.
Mine are Sunday theatre, because though there was a time when that sort, this sort of stuff happened a lot on television, and now, you know, it's rubbish and you have to go out to the movies to watch it, and all the better for it, actually, because this is, yeah, terrific little film. Before we sign off, though...
Because we're trying to power through.
Yeah, we're just conscious of time. After teasing Simon in his absence about being a tight show, this is now an extended one.
Here we are waffling away.
Adzabel asked us if we would...
No, the Mirka.
Oh, was it the Mirka?
Yeah, wasn't it? Or was it Adzabel?
Either. Both of them. You can all take some credit for this. Wanted to hear us discuss Holy Motors, Leos Carac... I can't pronounce that. Anyway,
I'm guessing the X is silent.
Maybe Kara. And this was a film that was played in the Auckland Film Festival, the Wellington Film Festival. And I know I've been watching, reading tweets about it from Australia as well. Due out, actually, in commercial cinemas, commercial release in Australia in October. No sign of a commercial release date for New Zealand. This is a film that defies description in terms of its plot or narrative.
There is no synopsis for you people. I'm sorry.
No. It's, I guess, you follow a strange character as he travels around Paris in the back of a limo full of stage makeup and tricks, and goes from scene to scene, transforming himself into different characters in order to play a particular role, and then at the end of each scene he goes back into the limo and reveals his true self, and then puts on another costume and for another scene. And it seemed to me that it was it's a kind of cliche to say a love letter to cinema, but I feel like it's that if it's about anything, it's about the movies, and about, because, you know, the actor who plays the lead role is like a Lon Chaney character, you know, this master of disguise, and the disguises are absolutely fantastic, the makeup effects and what have you, and he, but each scene that he becomes part of could be a scene from a movie, and he's conscious. They talk in the film about somebody watching. You know, they're not doing this for themselves, they're doing it for an audience. And it seemed to me that it was like, if you could imagine the characters in a film stopping the film for a moment and looking at the audience and going, see, look what you make us go through. Look what you make us do for your entertainment, you rat bags. Because they have to kill people, they have to be killed, they have to be mean, they have to they have to have their hearts broken, they have to be sexualized. And I'm not talking about necessarily what actors go through on our behalf, but, you know, if you could imagine the characters stopping for a moment and going, God damn it, this isn't fair. Having said that, you know, it's kind of interesting, and maybe my reading is a shallow one, but I wonder if it doesn't quite reach the profoundness that, say, something like Tree of Life, which it's been compared to in terms of its bafflingness. I found the Tree of Life to be quite profound and really quite heart tugging, whereas Holy Motors is extremely entertaining. Each scene, like, and is marvelous and often very, very funny, but I don't know if it really sort of got me in the heart the way that maybe other films have done. So what did you think?
I found it interesting. It was one of those, not to compare it to Abraham Lincoln in any sort of, you know, filmic way, but for me it was like Abraham Lincoln, where I started watching it and then at some point something just snapped and I sat back and was like, okay, I'm on this ride. I'm just going to accept it and watch it because I don't know what's going on, but I'm just going to go with it. And so for me it was just this really funny, fun ride of this guy going on a ride in this limo and going from scene to scene, and it's one of those films you're trying to figure out what's going on, you're trying to piece it together the whole time, and you know, what is
he
doing?
Actually, the second time around, you, when you're not worried so much about what it all means, you might enjoy it more.
Yeah.
So, but could you sit through it again?
I could sit through it again.
Yeah.
There's a couple scenes I kind of want to watch it like at home so I could fast forward through some, like, they're like the goblin scene with Eva Mendes. I'd just be like, that was weird.
Yep.
But I really enjoyed it. And it really split the people I went and saw it with. There's a group of us who were just like, what the hell did we just watch? That was hilarious. That was really funny. And the other half were like, that was the most awful masturbatory cinema crap I've ever seen in my life.
If you don't really know what to expect, then it is an example of almost everything wrong with art house cinema. Yeah. It's like a classic, the epitome of sort of art house wankerdom, and yet it's so funny and so gloriously realized. And technically, this is one of the few films that I've seen in recent years where I really want to see a making of documentary. Like I want to know how they did some of that stuff, because there's some real cinema magic in there. So, you know, while I like the fact that I can come up with my own ideas about what it's all about, I am actually intrigued by just the manufacture of it, and this extraordinary central performance as well.
Indeed, yeah. And in my research, you know, it's a film, like you said, it's about cinema, it's about making cinema, it's about there's literary references, there's, you know, everyday references, there's technological references, and there's all these things that's kind of just shoved in a blender, and you know, then you drink what's in the blender and then get on like the biggest roller coaster in the world. And at the end you're like, what's even going on? Well, because then God.
Yeah. Let's not even talk about the ending.
Let's not even talk about the end.
Well, I hope that we've illuminated or shed a little bit of light on Holy Motors for the benefit of the people who requested this discussion. Don't ask us to do this again, because that was actually quite difficult. Do you have two words, Kaylee?
Holy Mother.
Based on your beautiful description of Abraham Lincoln last week, my two words are prodigious bananas. That's Holy Motors. And that is our show for this week. Next week on the show, we will be interviewing the directors of How Far Is Heaven, the New Zealand documentary about the Sisters of Compassion in Jerusalem. That is a gorgeous film, and that's getting a release in Auckland next week. So we'll be talking about that. All that, of course, and more. All right. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favourite podcasting software, etc., etc. Leave us reviews, give us feedback, contact us via social media.
Yes, you can find us on Twitter at CinematicaCast, and tell your friends about us at CinematicaCast. Do that Follow Friday thing. It would be great. And on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematicapodcast.
We're losing the plot now.
And also on our website at cinematica.co.nz.
Give us some more requests. This show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, and you can buy that at the iTunes store. We're going to leave you with some more music. This is playing out in the background, is actually from Holy Motors, and this took a little bit of finding, let me tell you. This is the intermission music from the film, the accordion version of R.L. Burnside's Let My Baby Ride. That means it's good night from me.
And good night from me. Trois, douze, merde!